Good afternoon. My name is Clara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clara.
And I'm grateful to be sober today and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Bob and the committee for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is always a privilege and a miracle for me because I'm indeed a miracle. To stand here this afternoon, and I've come to believe in miracles because they're real and happen to those who are unafraid to believe in them. When I got to Alcoholic, I'd like to welcome the newcomers this afternoon and hope that you will keep coming back and join us. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, there is a page entitled The Spiritual Experience. And at the end of that reading, it says contempt prior to investigation will leave a man in everlasting ignorance. So join us in this incredible journey of sobriety. That's been my experience from my first meeting, which was April the 9th, 1974, and last month it was 21 years. And when I sat in that first meeting that night, by that time I was a Wynette. And in the book, Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, it describes the insane things that we continue to do to keep from doing Step 1 and 2. And in it, it says we switched to natural wines. Man, I had switched to Ripple. And that is not one of your natural wines. As a matter of fact, I don't think grapes have ever been near it. And they probably put some ether in little bottles and put some Kool-Aid in it to give me a choice whether I wanted the red Ripple or the white Ripple. And by that time, I was living in South Central Los Angeles in the ghetto with my two younger children, sick of living and scared to die. Had reached that place in my life where I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober and I couldn't stop drinking, and that's called madness. Drapes drawn, living on food stamps and welfare. And I believe that my alcoholism had affected the lives of every single person that loved me. And I can remember standing and looking in their eyes as they looked at me with that look that people who love you the most, and that look of despair and hopelessness and helplessness, and telling me I drank too much and I was going to kill myself if I didn't stop drinking. And the secret was I couldn't tell them that I couldn't stop drinking, but my arrogant attitude was all about I'll stop whenever I want to. And I always knew the fear on the inside that I couldn't. And by the time I sat at my meeting that first night, I sat there and I reviewed my life briefly, because I didn't really believe that I was an alcoholic. Mine was just a series of circumstances. You know, they all just get off my back and stop telling me I drank too much. And there I was sitting in that chair, and I reviewed my life, and what I saw was that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. It had stripped me of all moral values and family values that I had certainly learned growing up in a wonderful family. But that morning was the first time I'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'd come to on a dirty floor in that ghetto, and that wasn't my usual position inside of the house. By that time, I was sitting in an overstuffed chair, usually with a red wig on. And I'm a real alcoholic, and I had drank for 27 years, and it was at the end of that drinking that I was in horrendous blackouts most of the time. And I'd come too often out of the blackout, sitting in that chair late at night. And loneliness, I believe, is part of our disease. And I could hear those two children sleeping in that room. And I'd snap too out of the blackout, and I could hear my heart beating like a rapid drum. And I'd look around and I just want to hear the sounds, the voices of people who were laughing, and that was the laughter that I'd always heard on those bar stools. And I come from the jazz world in Boston, New York, and Harlem, and that was my favorite sounds, was the laughter over the music in those clubs. And instead I had the silence, And I'd have to get up out of that chair just to go to the nearest sleazy joint down around in South Central. I didn't have to go too far. There are lots of them in any direction. And I'd stand up and straighten up the wig and put on something presentable, take off the terry cloth robe, and sneak down the steps and get to the nearest place, sit on the stool, probably feeling like Eleanor Rigby, looking around the club and wondering where all those other lonely people were coming from. And I always had to have a drink or two and to give me the courage, because I always needed a drink or two to give me courage to do whatever it was that I needed to do. I'd look to my right, or I'd look to my left. There was always an intellectual sitting there. We start a little conversation. And by the end of the evening, we were legends in our own heads. And I'm sure what they would do is I would go in and out of those black houses. Very often they would dump me in the front yard. I know about coming to in the front yard in deep, wet grass. At that awful hour of the morning, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, and it always seemed dark as right before dawn. And if it was in the springtime or in the summer, I'd hear night birds calling to each other, squawking. Dogs grow up in packs in the ghetto. Strange-looking dogs, because they don't have owners. They just have those litters, and they drop them in the tall grass behind buildings and under empty houses. And I'm stretched out in the grass by that time. I've been in hallucinations for some time. Here, a dog had trucked by one morning that had the face of a German police with little short legs like a dash hound. And I'm laying in the grass saying, was that for real? I'm not sure about that one. But what dogs do in the ghetto is they sprout around for food at that hour of the night, and take several of them to knock over the can set out on the sidewalk, and it would take several of them to push it over. And I could hear the lid as it started to roll down the street, and that hour is so quiet. And first it would be rapid, and then the lid would slow down, and you could hear that quiet again. And them scrapping and fighting each other for the garbage in the cans. And it was my time to make a deal with God, because I'm coming from the streets. I knew when it was deal time. I didn't believe in God, but it was like about, oh, please, God, you know, if you just get me off the ground this morning. And that little 8-year-old daughter who had had to go to, and that 9-and-a-half-year-old son who had had to go to that ghetto with me. And every time I share that, you know, there's a certain feeling of sadness, because those kids had no choice. They had to go where the drunken mother had to take them. And that little daughter would come to me from time to time and say to me, Mom, please, won't you go to PTA meetings, because all the other kids' parents come and you always promise and you never show up. And I would look at her and I would feel that guilt and the shame, and I'd say, I know, darling, next time I'm really going to make an effort to do that. And I'm standing in the yard now, bouncing around, trying to straighten myself up, and I would make those promises to God, get rational once in a while. I said, God, if you listen, if you just let me not drink today, I'll even go to PTA meetings. I'm 21 years sober. I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet. Because what would happen is the phenomenon of craving would start, as the wonderful Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, in front of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about the alcoholics phenomenon of craving, and I'd need a drink, because by that time I needed to drink the minute my eyes were open. To quiet the insanity that was always going on, I'd spin around a little bit, look around, and try to straighten up that wig, see who's looking. Nobody in South Central Los Angeles was concerned about a drunk woman in the front yard at any time, day or night. And looking good almost killed me out there. I look across the street. I don't know about you guys. Maybe you have a lady in your neighborhood that was concerned about who's coming and going out of your house all the time. I never knew that woman. As a matter of fact, I didn't really go down to that ghetto to become sociably accepted in the community. I really now know I was probably guided down there because I was going to die of this disease. I don't think she ever slept. I look over any time, and I see a little curtains moving back and forth, you know. Now, after I get my cool look in the yard, give her the finger. Scream lady like up yours, you know. And then I turn to get up those steps, and God forbid she should think I'm drunk. I get through the door, and I could feel that pain of the sickness. By that time, I was drinking my meals. And I was dying physically, emotionally, and spiritually dying. And I would have to charge down that hall and get to that bathroom, get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim. You know, sliding around, trying to find a comfortable place to rest. And then I would throw up as if I was going to throw up my very soul. Curl up in that fetal position at the bottom of the toilet. Come to out of another blackout. Watch the room spinning. Try to slow down the spin by focusing on something that I could make just stop down, just stop that spinning. The two words that always greeted me was American Standard. You know, my view was always from the bottom of the floor looking up at the bottom of the toilet and my face leaning on the cold porcelain. I know what the... You know, you talk about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I couldn't believe my life had come to that. Get up, break the promise, promise those kids the day before that Mama was not going to go down to the liquor store. I'd have to pull on those tight jeans over that 65 overweight body, 65 pounds, and the pants had gotten a little tight, put on my bad leather jacket, straighten up that wig, put on some starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders. My mode of transportation by that time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. And then I go quietly past the door and get out of the house. It was always dark, it seemed. Cross the street, get in front of the liquor store door down on the avenue. Watching the world come alive. I'd get there before the clerk because it was too painful to circle inside and wait for him to open. Leaning on the door and watching people go off to work who were taking the responsibility for their lives and the lives of people they love and also supporting me, the alcoholic who was no longer employable. Wondering what happened to all those fair-weather friends, I mean the ones that I had wined and dined and bought all the love that I could afford. When I used to sit in those jazz clubs in the East, I used to look in the mouth of the late great legend Billie Holiday. And she used to sing a song about when the spending ends and the money is gone, they don't come around no more. Bill Wilson, our co-founder of our program that I believe was divinely inspired. And in his chapter, he talked about his fair-weather friends. Not one ever showed up on those cold mornings and leaned on that door with me and said, Clara, how are you this morning? And what are you going to do about your life today? And when are we going to lunch? Those days had long been over. Finally, the guy would come driving up on the parking lot in his big, bad Lincoln with the wide, white-walled tires. And I hated that guy. I'd had all of those things. And alcohol is not prejudiced about who it takes it from, because it was gone. And I'd wait for this guy with this ring of keys, and I'm standing there trying to be cute. I hadn't been cute for a couple of years by now. You don't exactly smell too great when Ripple is coming out of the pores of your skin in the morning. It certainly doesn't smell like Chanel No. 5. And those days that I had been cute and played those games out there, one of my problems is I knew how to play the game of life. I just didn't know how to live it. And when he'd get his little key, the right key, and I'm standing there like I'm going to self-destruct if he doesn't hurry up, and we get inside to do a little business, stand at the counter, watch him put the change away. And then, it's something about clerks in the ghetto. This guy particularly, I always remember him when I share my story because he was the one that I seemed to have been there the most during those mornings. and look at you and ask you dumb questions. Turn the head sideways. What you gonna have this morning, darling? Well, now listen, sweetheart, I didn't come in here for milk. I didn't get up this early to come down here for milk. Now let's just do a little business. You put that wine in the bag and let me go. And he put it in the bag and played with the paper at the top. You know, and he, some mornings be really cruel. And then I'd have to reach over and take it. Pay the 59 cents, throw it up on the counter. In service in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to give back the gift that was freely given to me from that first meeting when I sat there that night. I'm in service in the penal, in H&I work in the state of California. And I get the opportunity to go into a lot of the prisons and jails and hospitals. And I was sharing the story about my 59 cents up there at a prison in Northern California. And a young guy at the back of the room raised his hand and he said, "Lady, it's gone up." he said, "It's $1.18. And I assured him I was glad I quit while I was ahead. Get out of this man's sight. Pass a little plate glass window, lean on the building. My days for fine drinking had long been over. I didn't have to worry about, you know, crystal glasses and the proper stirrers and cocktail napkins and the faces of smiling, handsome men. You see, all I had to do was take the top off of that bottle and take a hit. And Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. You see, it quieted the insanity, told me everything was going to be all right, that yesterday was a disaster, but tomorrow's going to be better. And the fantasies would begin. Truck back to that house and sit in that chair. Hear two kids come out of a dirty bedroom. It was a little tiny place, and they had to share the room. Go into the kitchen and make their breakfast and make their lunch. And I'm sitting in the chair, you know, staring out of the window, watching the dawn come up. Sometimes feeling like the man who probably said, "I had a dream last night. The life was passing me by. I was no longer in the dreams of life." And hear them go past the doors. They never once said, "I'll see you later, Mom." Heads down and past the window. We tell our stories in a general way. I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and what was considered at the time a very affluent family. And I'm the youngest of seven children, and my parents were not alcoholics and are not responsible for the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I believe what Dr. Silkworth says in his opinion, that it's a threefold disease, a physical allergy, coupled with an obsession of mine and a spiritual malady. And I am one of the ones who could have used a little drinky pool probably in the first grade, because I was emotionally ready for a drink in the first grade. I believe I was born restless, irritable, and discontented right out of the chute. I started having a lot of trouble, and I mentioned my father because I believe that my father's statue and image was, I don't know what it caused me to have a lot of feeling about, a fear about authority. And it's taken me years in Alcoholics Anonymous to get past that emotional feeling about authority and people telling me what to do. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian who was born on a reservation in North Carolina and who migrated to Atlanta when he was about 21. And he met my mom, and it was a wonderful marriage, and he was a wonderful father. As I understand it today, I do a lot of inventories. But it was something, and he was a very gentle man and very spiritual. I had a lot of problems with my parents, and I had taken my responsibility for that when I'd done the fourth step. He was an artist, and so I had a lot of problems with the fact that he was, I don't know what it was about his success or whatever it was about him, but it set up an image for me that was to create for me a lot of problems. In high school, I was a loner. I didn't know how to get along with people, and when I was a senior in that high school, I won an art scholarship that was to take me out of Atlanta. And, oh, man, I loved it, sitting on that segregated train. When that train pulled out, I gave Atlanta the finger. And because I didn't like the church, I have nothing against the church today. When I read and study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the chapter to the agnostic, I have no problems with it today, but it caused me a lot of problems when I was growing up. I didn't like the system. A lot of trouble with the system. I didn't like the system in Georgia, and I didn't like the teachers. And when I won that art scholarship, I thought this was my freedom to get out of that town. And I went to Boston, Massachusetts, to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, so that's where I won this scholarship too. And it never occurred to me when I got there that I was taking me with me. Same feelings. That same feeling of feeling inadequate, feeling that feeling of low self-esteem, and I just always felt that way. I always tried to look good on the outside so you wouldn't know the secret that what I felt about myself. Walked into that school, it was a mistake, and another secret I had was that I didn't really want to go there. I heard a man at the Poem of Alcoholics Anonymous once say, we are sick as our secrets. And my secret was I wanted to be a performer. And I wanted to go into the jazz world. And I don't know how I ever got into that one, since I can't sing and I can't dance. But it seemed like a wonderful idea. I always looked at other people. I hung out in the movies a lot. I cut that school and get out of those classes and go to the movies and sit there and watch people up on the screen live, because I didn't know how to reach out and touch anybody. I didn't know anything about emotions. My mother, when I was growing up, had always said to me, stay away from boys, and I never got answers from any of these things. It was always a mystery to me. And I never seen alcohol. Georgia was a dry state when I grew up there, and I don't recall until this day, ever seeing anybody drunk. And I didn't know alcohol existed. And one night I was walking down the street with another student, and I heard this great jazz music come out of a door. Some people walked out. And I just said to this friend, why don't we go in there and see what they do? And it was a jazz club. And it was dark, and the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and it was dimly lit, and down at the end of the bar was this rather heavy lady, and she was grinding out this soulful music, and my heart started pumping. And I had that sudden feeling of living on the edge. And that feeling was to follow me until I got to that ghetto when I not only was living on the edge, I was already over the edge. And when I walked in there and I sat on a stool, and the bartender said, what are you going to have to drink? Well, I didn't know, but I know in the movies they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. Leaned on that bar and looked at him. I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. Had no idea what a dry martini was. Guy turns around, puts these two stem glasses up there, evens it out. It looks like lemonade. Now, in Georgia, we drank a lot of lemonade when it was hot. And I didn't know you sip drinks. So I pick it up, and I open my mouth. I look around, and I dump it all at one shot. I was a pig from the gate. And I loved the way it made me feel. I tell you what that first drink did for me. It quieted the silent screaming that was always going on in my head. And I believe with that first drink that the light of my very soul began to dim. And by the time the light went out, it was on that floor in the ghetto. And that morning of April the 9th, 1974, was an entire change in what I had, I believe, for me was a divine intervention. But I looked around that club. I got myself some friends right away. I was about 19 years old. I'd never had a date. And I hooked up with some new friends. I called them colorful. But the big book calls them loyal companions. I hooked up with the pimps, the hookers, the madams, and the bad boys. And I learned real fast how to walk the walk and talk the talk. And I still love jazz, and my favorite jazz artist is Randy Crawford, and she sings a song about street life. She says, if you are young, don't get old in the streets. Cold's going to hit you in the back, and you're going to nickel and dime your life away. You're going to look back one day, it was all a masquerade. What you have to do in the streets is you have to learn to be a role player. So I walked out there and learned to play the role. And on those stools every night, for a long time, and they finally kicked me out of that school. I'm sitting on that stool one night. I met a nice young man who came from a similar background. He didn't know much about drinking either. And we became drinking buddies, and then we got married. And I was to stay in that relationship for about 24 years. The sickest relationship I think the two people could have ever been together. You know, in the bodies of adults with the emotions of 2 5-year-old kids. And, I sponsor a lot of women. It's always a privilege to sponsor in sponsorship. The women I sponsor light up my life. And when they ask me about relationships, I said, well, the only thing I can describe about that one was the rocks in his head fit the hole in mine. And we stayed out there and played, and we had a little song. It was the beginning of any kind of feeling that I could have imagined that would start to happen to me, and we pushed him off on his grandparents to raise him. And in my opinion, there is nothing sadder than to look into the eyes of a child when you continue to lie to him because you cannot tell him the truth. Dr. Silkworth says for us alcoholics, there comes a time when we can't differentiate the difference between the truth and the false. And when I would go and visit him and he started to grow up and they started to ask you questions. Like, Mom, you promised me last time you were coming, that you came here, you would take me to the park. And I would agree and I would pat him on the head and get out of his sight because he didn't realize I just didn't have time. You see, what was going on in my personal life and my selfish and self-centered life was much more important than trying to nurture a child, and I simply didn't know how to do that. See, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of this program, and honoring this tradition, you know, you told me what would happen, that if I did those steps and if I learned to coordinate those steps and live them in my life, it would set me free. So I can tell you the truth that I just simply did not want to do it because I was too busy. There's a paragraph in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous when it says selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. And that we are driven people. We are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And I could have added to my list ad infinitum all those fears. But it was easier to get out of his sight and get back downtown. That husband traveled with his family, owned a business, and he traveled with his dad a lot, and I was just still out there looking for Mr. Wonderful. I have learned in sobriety that I have an addictive personality. One of anything is not enough. So when he was away, I was looking for that father image, that somebody that was going to take care of me, and I would not have to take any responsibility for my life. And I'm in an after-hour club one morning sitting on a bar stool, and Billie Holiday was sitting next to me, and we were drinking together. And so if you're in those clubs in Boston, Harlem, and New York long enough, Mr. Wonderful will show up. And this guy eased down the bar. I mean, real cool, just eased down the bar. And I'm sitting there chatting, and when I look up, he was standing there, and this dude had a black hat turned down all the way around, had a top coat over his shoulders. And he was so cool, he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. He closed one eye, reached in his pocket, pulled out this wad of money. Man, my eyes got that big. I love money. And he peeled off 10 $100 bills. He spread it on the bar like a deck of cards, and he whispered, "Spend it." Now, I didn't believe in God, but God sure had answered my prayer on this one. And I was already into step two by now. And Mr. Wonderful turned out to be the head of the mafia of the Boston family. And I couldn't believe it. I believe that I come to crossroads in my life and then during that time, and that God from time to time would try to get my attention, but I would always step out on the road that was self-destructive. And I had no idea what the mafia was, but I just knew a big limousine would pull up in front of my apartment with two bodyguards in it, and I would sneak out there and crawl up in the back of that limo. Totally insane by now. Stop going to visit that child. That was just too much. I didn't have time for that. One Sunday morning, I guess when God, we call it in Alcoholics Anonymous, a moment of clarity, I looked out. We were at a stoplight, and there were young families standing on the corner. The light was red. We were all hungover. All the hardware was on the floor, and the holsters were out of the gun. The guns were out of the holsters, and they were down on the floor. And I looked over at the corner, and I saw these lovely young families with their little kids. My son was probably 10 years old by now, and I had stopped visiting him. And it was like a voice said to me, "Clara, something's wrong with your life," and I agreed. The problem was Boston. If I just get out of Boston, stop hanging out with the hood, and the pimps and all these people, you know, these lowlifes. You know, and I had become one of the lowlifes. And I made that decision. We left Boston, moved to the Los Angeles area. It was all with good intention. Put that kid in the back of that car, and we drove across Route 66. And I went, you know, I bought a case of, by that time I was drinking 101 proof bourbon, wild turkey on the rocks. I bought a whole case of it and put it in the trunk of the car to go and change my life to a better way of living. Tell about the insanity of this disease. And we got into Los Angeles, and we had two other children, went into a little small maintenance business that became quite successful. And we had it all. We had it all. And my family, my wonderful, loving family. And I certainly have with the eighth and ninth step. I've done that eighth and ninth step with them, and it's a continuous. For me, it's easy to just say I'm sorry. I said that for years and would do the same thing over again. But the eighth and ninth step means for me not only to make amends for and take responsibility for my action and behavior in their lives, but it has to be a continuing, loving action that has made our relationship wonderful. I began to drink it all away. I had crossed that line long ago. It came that time, I never thought I'd stand at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, thank you, God. Thank you. That you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed. It came that time in my life when I needed to get sober and I needed to find a God of my understanding. And I simply needed to stop dying. The family had moved out, those brothers and sisters who had become successful in their various careers and in the educational world, and they started talking about to each other about my drinking. So I just kind of stayed away from them. When I was standing outside the house and it was all gone, God had answered my prayer, because it was time for me to stop. And I thought then, you know, it's something if I moved and got out of there. But instead, the Internal Revenue took the business. The bank foreclosed on the house. I'm standing outside. That older son was 10 years older than the two younger ones. And we're standing on the sidewalk. The husband had gone, because by now I'm in violent behavior as a result of blackouts. And I was the one who instigated the behavior and was getting beat up a lot out there. He left because he said he could not stand this and he was not going to live, because it was going to be a choice. He was going to kill me or I was going to kill him. So he left. And I'm standing on the sidewalk with that older son, and he's grown up and the look is different. 18 years old, tears in his eyes, but they didn't run. I guess it wasn't macho for an 18-year-old young man to cry over a drunken mother who was beginning to wake up with strangers. And he said, I'm not going to the ghetto with you because I don't even know who you are. And I wish I could have said to him, as I looked at him, if I could have said to him, but you don't understand. I'm doing the best I can. If I could do better, I'd do better. But instead, my arrogance said, and screw you too. And I turned and I walked away from here. And by that time, I was always in the process of silent tears. Silent tears about broken dreams and unresolved relationships. And I turned with the two younger ones and picked the bag and went into Watts. Started ending up in hospitals and places with strangers. By that time, men in my life had faces and no names. I was in Daniel Freeman Hospital. It was a little hospital right outside of the ghetto area. Catholic hospital. I came to one Sunday morning one more time. Paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. Lying there that Sunday morning with two nuns standing on the side of the bed and the police at the foot of the bed. And they had the equipment and jumping my heart back. And I look up, and the older nun wasn't thrilled with me at all, because I was giving her a lot of lip. I always gave people lip when I was terrified the most. And they would stay away from me and go away from me, and they wouldn't have to know the kind of pain that I was always going through. And she turned and she stormed out of the room. But the young nun stood there probably 23 years old with a gray habit on, and all I could see was her face. And her eyes were as blue as the heavens. And I looked up at her, and this young nun was crying. The spiritual being that she is, wherever she is. Because I've never seen her, I've never known her name. She looked down at my face and she said, "Tell me, how did you ever let your life get into such a state?" And my arrogance looked at this young nun and wanted to know, what does she know what it takes to live out there in that world and in those streets? But instead, I had the message I have come to believe in earth angels. Because I, for the first time in my life, heard somebody say something was wrong with my life. And this time I really agreed. She looked down. I had a brain concussion. With this one, I remember a pair of black boots. Black boots are pointed, and they are very painful when you're being kicked and you're in the gutter. My face looked like somebody had used it for a trampoline, and I remember my ribs being kicked out one at a time, and I know about pain. And the pain of the alcoholic woman and what we go through. My ribs were being kicked out, and there I was, with the emotional pain and the physical pain, and I was living the life of the jaywalk in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first read that in the book, my reaction was, how absurd. Nobody could be that crazy. And the more I look back over my life and during my alcoholic behavior and the height of my alcoholism, I kept doing insane things over and over again, expecting a different result. They take me up, 2-inch wide adhesive tape. 3 days later, they kept me because of the brain concussion, and that same young nun was appointed to me out of all those nuns in that hospital. I have to believe, that she was sent there by God to help me, and then she put on that bad leather jacket, straightened up that red wig. You should have seen her. Though she had the bangs over on the side, and she didn't really know what any of that was about, and she walked with me to the front door and stood outside and said to me quietly, "Try not to drink today, but I'm an alcoholic." Bent over in pain, walked down to the nearest liquor store, and I bought myself some wine and went back to the ghetto to heal. I always sat in those chairs and healed on the outside, and I was always continued the pain inside, didn't have any place to go. And that morning, when I came to, I heard myself do something I always sworn I would never do, and that was pray. Since I didn't believe in God, there was no sense in praying. But I heard myself with another voice that was a little deeper than the tone of my voice as you hear me this afternoon, saying, "God, please, please don't let me die." And I don't know where that came from, but I found myself standing up in that room. And when Bill Wilson described who was an agnostic, when he described his spiritual experience by calling the wonderful doctor he was questioning his own sanity, and he told him what had happened to him, and the doctor said, "Well, I don't know anything about that, whatever happened to you, but you hang on to it, it's better than what you had before." And he talked about the feeling of the clear wind blowing through and through, and that he supposed that God come to most men gradually, but his impact upon him had been sudden and profound. And that's what happened to me that morning. And I stood up and I called the central office, because I'd called a friend who told me about central office. A man said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you?" And I said, "Man, my name is Claire, and I can't stop drinking," and the truth was finally out. He said, "We don't drink in Alcoholics Anonymous, dear," he said, "one day at a time." He said, "And don't drink today." And it just seemed too simple. I was an intellectual out there, and that just seemed too simple not to drink today. But I took him at his word, and what I heard from that stranger on the telephone earlier that morning was hope. And newcomers, that's what we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're about hope. So there I was, getting dressed that morning to go to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and like the chairperson, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous until that morning. And I didn't know what you were about. So about 10 o'clock, I didn't know the language about detoxing and all of that. I have learned that the language is the language of the heart. And so there I was about 10 o'clock on what to wear. I got one dress, a red velvet dress. It had wine stains on it. And I'm standing in the closet trying to decide. And I got the dress out, got some soap and water and a little brush, cleaned up the wine stains as best I could, got that wig out, clipped some better bangs, and got some hairspray, you ladies, and just put a little bouffant on it, you know, and put it on that head, you know, that head that we keep the wigs on. It was looking pretty good, you know. And around 2 o'clock, I couldn't stand. My body was aching. You talk about a body aching in Rockwood Bay. And I decided to go over to Woolworths and browse. While I was browsing, I stole some eyelashes to wear to my first meeting. And they come quite long, and I didn't know you're supposed to trim them. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. I borrowed a car from my brother. And I'm standing in front of the meeting at 7 o'clock. I got this little tube of glue that comes with the lash. And I'm bouncing so, and perspiration just pouring off me. I'm trying to get it along the edge. And after I got it on there, you know, I hold my elbow, and I wait for an opportune moment. And I slammed the lash in. And one end was up here and one end was down there. And I leaned in the mirror. I said, "You looking good." Went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in that chair that night. And they greeted me and they said, "Keep coming back." And I hadn't been greeted and asked back for a long time from anyone. And they told me to get a cup of coffee. They had real coffee cups in those days. And I walk over to the table and I filled it too full. And I was ashamed to let you see me bouncing. So I put it down on the table and I went back and sat. And they started the meeting and they asked for the hands of the newcomer. And the lady behind me, because I didn't raise my hand, touched me on my shoulder. She said, "Raise your hands, honey, you're a newcomer." And I raised my hand and they said, "If you don't like what we've got here, you know, try us for 90 days. And if you don't want what we've got, you know, you're welcome to go back to your misery." And that was the beginning of my journey of sobriety and life. I finally found out through Alcoholics Anonymous what life is about. I knew about what a lifestyle was about for years. She gave me a number and she said, "Go home and call me and I'll tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is about." She offered to be my sponsor that night, and she's still my sponsor at this moment. For 21 years, she has walked with me. She has been my friend, my confidant, and my spiritual teacher. And I still call her because life keeps happening, and I still need her guidance. And when you get too well, you know, I got too well when I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and that's a very dangerous place to get. She started me in the steps, and we went through the steps, and I did the fourth step, and I wasn't an honest first step. I remember reading it to her when I did the fifth step, and she said, "That was a very nice fourth step you wrote that there, but it's not yours." She said, "You took everybody's inventory. And you go back and do it right." And then the second one I did was a better one. And then I made amends to those kids of mine. That oldest son, when he left me in front of that house, had gone to his grandparents, and he told his grandparents that I had gone insane and that he could no longer be around me and that he needed to get out of that town and go to another place because it was just he didn't want to live there anymore. And so they gave him a ticket, and he went to Japan, and he lived there for a while, and he went to India, and he lived there for a while. And he was in the performing arts, and he was very talented. And I was two years sober when he came back to the city. And I took them all in a room, and I sat them down, and I told them, I said, I am sorry that I was never there for you. The 27 years of daily drinking that I did, I couldn't be there for you. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a sober woman today. And I don't ever have to live like that again. And why don't we just go start at this point and go on. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the family afterwards, I started to get really involved in that. And my sponsor sent me to the Al-Anon family group. And my first 5 years was a combination of my Al-Anon family group and AA because I didn't know how to be a parent. I'd never been one, and I didn't know how to be a single parent. So we got on with that, and I'm glad that my sponsor pushed for that eighth and ninth step. That daughter, little daughter of mine, grew up. The grandparents paid for the training, and I saw her go into the ice capades when I was 5 years sober as the first black professional ice skater with the Dorothy Hamill tutor. And when I was 7 years sober, that 9.5-year-old little son who had to go in and suffer that degrading behavior of a mother, that I used to look at his eyes and I used to feel the pain of having that son look at me, and I didn't know what to say to him. He attempted suicide with 150 sleeping pills, and I guess his higher power saw to it that he was saved, and he's today a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That older son moved on to New York and got a grant in one of the major television companies in New York in the news department because he'd learned to speak languages. And in the early 80s, he got into intravenous drug using. He was shooting cocaine in the high towers of New York in the fast lane in the television world. And when his contract was over, he moved back to Los Angeles, and he met a lovely young lady and got married, and they had a little son. The marriage didn't last. It was a very short marriage, but I have a little grandson, and his name is Aaron. And God has given me a second chance. When I promise Aaron we're going to the park, man, we go to the park. Mostly we go to Toys R Us. And I, you know, I had gone into, back when I was 2 years sober, about 3 years sober, I'd gone back into the business. I drank away, and that's what I do today. I have a contract to the homes of the movie stars, and I started it in my home group because my sponsor made me get a job. When I really wasn't thrilled about getting a job when I was about 6 months sober so I could get out of that ghetto. And she said, look, you know, the mafia is not taking care of you. You've got to get a job. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. And I got a job as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. I spilled a lot of coffee, had a bad attitude. And never could figure out why I never got tips, you know. And I go to my home group and just whine. I whined my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one night I'm whining about how mean they were to me out there in that world. And this man came out at the back of the meeting, and he put his arms around me, and he said, Claire, please, come down off the cross. he said, we need the wood. And so as things got better for me, I bought this nice little house, and you know, and then I was able to take a lot of care of my grandson and spend a lot of time with him. My daughter had a little daughter, and she has a wonderful marriage, and so I was invited to the birth of their little child. I have a little granddaughter named Nicole, and you know the miracle of this program and living the life that this program gives us through the grace of God, that I was invited to be at the birth of my little granddaughter, to walk in that room and. These young people, they have something about the Le Mans system, and my daughter was in pain, and my son-in-law was playing tapes, you know, seagulls were chirping, and tears were running down her face, and she's a very attractive young lady, and she reached out and took my hand, and we kissed, and she said, Mother, I'm glad you're here, and I love you. And that said, boy, I want to tell you, without this program, none of this could have happened. My son later on, that older son, called me. He'd moved up into San Francisco area and was teaching theater arts. And he called me one day and he said, Mom, he said, you know, my drug use and back, I just found out I'm HIV positive. And my son died of AIDS the day before that awful earthquake last year. I couldn't be there for him when he was a little boy. But by God's grace in this program, I was there for him, the family was there for him, and all of the earth angels from Alcoholics Anonymous was there. And he called me and he said, it's time to die. and I want to come home. And he came back to Los Angeles, and I spent a lot of time with him. And we shared. I thought I knew pain. There is no pain like the pain of holding the hands of a dying child. And he went from, he was a very, very handsome young man, and he went from 165 pounds to 100 pounds. He went blind. The disease ate him alive. And I used to hold his hands. And we would share, and he looked at me one day when he could still talk. And he said, "Mother, I love your Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Because, Alcoholics Anonymous gave to us what we'd never had before. You're the mother we always wanted, and you're the lady we always knew you could be." And that morning, before that earthquake, we were around that bed, and we were singing. And helping him to bridge that gap to another place. And I wish I could have done something absolutely powerless, that I couldn't give him the next breath. And when he gasped in that last breath, I didn't know what else to do. There was a legal pad on the nightstand, and I reached over and I picked up that pad and a pen. And I wrote God, not a note, but I wrote God a letter. And thanked him that he had him in my life and had loaned him to me and the family. For a short 44 years. And I asked God to forgive me if I had harmed him in any way or made him any pain in his life. And I prayed that, to God, that his soul would soar to a higher place, where there was no more crying and there was no more dying and there was no more pain. And I was blessed with his presence for those years. And it's times like that, you know, I tapped into that 11th, 10th, and 11th and 12th step. And my daily prayer is, I am of service on the board of directors of a halfway house, and I got the opportunity when I was about 4 years sober to do a 12-step call that guided me to where I am in this program of service. I had gotten pretty well by four. You look around the rooms and everybody's looking good. And the insanity returns. And the book says the alcoholic at certain time has no effective mental defense against the first drink. That defense must come from a higher power. And when I was dancing around my room one Saturday afternoon, forgetting, you know, standing in front of the liquor store door at 6 o'clock in the morning, sometimes I had lost all body control, the phone rang and central office was calling. And a lady said, "Clara, we have a 12-step call. We wish you would take it." And I said to her, "Where is it?" I wasn't really thrilled with the idea that I was going to go on a 12-step call. I'd been on panels and all of that, but never anything on my own. I'd never been asked before. And she said, "Well, it's on Skid Row." And I said, "Oh, I don't think I'm qualified. I got a big Eldorado now, and I don't think I'm qualified." And she got really annoyed with me. She said, "Oh, stop it." She said, "Just take the name and the number." And I'd always heard you never turn down an AA request. So I was afraid that there was something about me being afraid to do that. So I got all the information. I called my sponsor. I said, "Carol," I ran it down to her. And I, you know, and finally I was getting no response from her. And I said, "Look, I don't want to do it." And she said, "I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway." And she hung up. So then I'd always heard that you never go on a 12-step call alone. I was sponsoring this little Hollywood actress. She had about 90 days. So I pick up the phone, you know. I said, "We're going on a 12-step call." She said, "Where?" I said, "We're going down to Skid Row." She said, "Oh, I don't want to do that." I said, "I don't care what you don't want to do." I said, "You get dressed." So we get in my big car and we find the address. And it's the hotel. The lady had told me it didn't have a name on the outside. It's just a number. It was not part of a Hilton chain, tell you that. So we park and we go into this lobby, and they were in there. They had one of these big transistor radios. Man, they were in there dancing. I could smell the beer and the wine, and the urine was all, it just smelled awful. And there was no clerk around. It was a red arrow along the wall and pointed to a bell. And I said, ring this bell for attention, and I did. And this guy comes out, and I said, do you have somebody in here named Dorothy? He said, oh, God, yeah, she's up on the top, on the third floor. And he said, now you take the elevator, go up there, and we don't have numbers in this hotel. She's at the end of the hall. So we get on this elevator, and we go up there, and we step over three drunks who had passed out. We just stepped over them, getting down to the end of the hall, and we knock on the door. And a little voice said, come in. And I believe that when you talk about the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the step, we try to carry the message. A walk in there and all that arrogance and selfishness and self-centeredness that was an old idea by this time in this program. We walk in there and a 21-year-old young blonde woman was curled up on the floor in a fetal position. Water bugs were so huge you could hear them crawling. They were scattering when we walked in. They were coming out of the drawers and the filth and the stench and wine balls were everywhere. And she was gagging and throwing up on her own vomit. And it was, if I saw an image of a light. And I believe at that moment God had me as a messenger and had Constance as a messenger trying to carry the message to another dying alcoholic. God gave me the chance to see it with my own eyes how devastating this disease is. And all of the other stuff went out of the window. We picked her up and we cleaned her up and we put a little pink sweater on and we got her between us. I went downstairs. I called central office. They told me where to take her further into L.A., that area, and that they had a place down there where they could take them if they got a call from central office. And we got her in there. We got her registered. And we took her to an all-night diner that's still there. And as a result of that 12-step call, I started 4 meetings on Skid Row that I'm still very active in. And we get her in that diner. We're sitting across from her. It's about 3:00 in the morning. This started at 2:00 the day before. And I'm talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and these steps. Trying to tell her they would save her life. Talked about the first step and talked about the second step, and I got to the third step and I said, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. And she stood up and said, don't you talk to me about God. And I hadn't been doing too well on the third step myself, and I'd just been looking good around the meeting. And I stood up. I think I had some unresolved anger. And I reach across the table, and I grab her by her and I pull her for a mamma, punch her lights out. You know, it says, having had a spiritual awakening, yeah, it didn't say beat them up if they don't want it, you know. So I let Dorothy go. And I don't know where Dorothy is this afternoon, but she will never know how her life touched mine and changed the course of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've come to believe that God had a purpose for my life when I had never had one. And I am doing what I believe that God wants me to do. Every morning on my knees, I thank you, God, I say. When I see the light of the dawn, I say, good morning, God. Thank you for another day. And that I am sober by your grace. Let me be a channel in some small way to someone you're trying to reach. You can have the same gift that we are all given through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and in this fellowship. And I get up and I go about my life and the ups and downs. And it's rooms like this that you have rendered me sober and you have rendered me sane to give me this life. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you.